actually, you know, your name was one of our not a target list, but you know, one that if we reached to speak with you, you know, it would show so much progress. And
so it's a great honour to have you. And I really enjoyed your talk for Action for Happiness when you came to London. Most entertaining.
Thank you.
And inspirational. And so, yeah, thank you. As just to echo what G said about what a privilege it is to have you with us today.
Yeah, and you know, there are so many great YouTube videos and of course your books that explain, you know, about how your involvement in mindfulness and your continued relationship with Google and how that allowed you to, you know, express your interest and share it, and through that amazing results happened. So I thought we would begin, if in your own words, you know, you're probably the best at explaining this story, but perhaps in a few minutes, if you could give our listeners a bit of background before we jump into perhaps some of the deeper issues of mindfulness.
My background is Rintara.
Yeah, can you explain that background to us in a bit more detail?
It's actually a picture that's painted personally by His Holiness, the 17th Karmapa. So I received it as a gift from him. It was like, yeah, it was amazing. I was like, wow, okay. He painted it himself.
I suppose the journey and how you found, I mean, you mentioned it briefly in your new book. Misery was your constant companion.
Yes.
And I'm sorry to say, but that made me feel a bit better because I'm not alone in having had misery as a companion.
Right, so yeah, you would like to hear my story, right?
Yes, please.
Is that what you're asking for?
Yeah.
When I was young, I was like miserable. And I was miserable enough that I was willing to try anything to get out of misery. And so we didn't have hippies, we didn't have drugs, because I was in Singapore, and possession of drugs carry a death penalty kind of thing. Yeah. But we did have other things. We did have, we did have books. We didn't have religion.
Yeah. Right?
And so I just went searching, and I eventually found Buddhism and meditation. Yeah. And the way I found it was, a little bit, serendipitous. I was listening to a talk by a Tibetan Buddhist nun. Her name is Venerable Sangye Kadro. She's American, and she's a monk in the Tibetan order. And I remember in the middle of her talk, there was one sentence. And the sentence is, she said, it is all about cultivating the mind. Mm. And I had my, oh my gods moment. Like, I'm polytheist, so it's oh my gods, you know. So it's like suddenly everything in my life made sense. Like everything made sense. Mm. And I told myself, from this moment on, right here, right now, I'm a Buddhist. Yeah. And I'm going to learn meditation, no matter how hard it is.
Yeah.
And it turns out it was really hard.
Yes.
For a variety of reasons. One of it is that meditation was not mainstream at the time. Yeah, it was like kind of fringe thing.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, it was, and things that we teach today, they were not well explained back then to the civilians, mm-hmm. because they were like tailored for monks and nuns, right? So it was a really long struggle. And for me, the struggle began with even the most basic thing. So I can tell you for certain that I was the worst meditator in the world, like literally. And I tell you why. Because I had problem breathing. Mm. Every time I had to bring attention to my breath, I couldn't breathe properly. Yeah, it was that bad. Like, it's like, you make jokes. It's like, this guy's so stupid, he doesn't know how to breathe. Yeah, that was me. So I had to begin from there. Mm-hmm. Right. Mm-hmm. And for me, my first breakthrough moment was one, I just kept trying, and one day I just gave up because it didn't work. Mm-hmm. I gave up in a disciplined manner. So instead of just gave up, just sat there and doing nothing, because I committed to sitting. So I just sat. And while I was just sitting there, I suddenly noticed, after a few minutes, I noticed myself breathing. And I said, oh, this is the first time I'm experienced of paying attention to the breath and still was able to breathe. Okay. And all I had to do was do nothing. It's fascinating, right? So in other words, I learned something like in today's parlance, the way I teach it now, it turns out that relaxation is the most important thing. The foundation of meditation is relaxation. Mm. On top of relaxation, then you build effort. and then you can build progress. But you have to build a foundational realization. I didn't have that.
Okay. Yeah.
So I had that. And then eventually something happened. After a few years, I progressed. And one fine day, I just suddenly realized it. I realized that if nothing is happening, I was happy. Mm. And then I reflect back, like in the past. In the past, if nothing's happening, I was miserable.
Yeah. Mm.
Something good has to happen for me to be miserable.
Yeah.
And then today, if nothing's happening, I'm just happy.
Yes.
I was like, holy. And then I realized something. I realized that first, happiness was a skill that I kind of figured out accidentally over time.
Yes.
And second thing is that if I can do it, such a flawed, useless human being like me, if I can do it, everybody can do it.
Mm.
And so I set out to try to make this accessible to everybody.
Yeah.
Yes. That was the beginning of my story.
Yeah, so how did that transition take place? So you were working for Google, so how did it come about that, you know, you introduced mindfulness there? And, you know, that's often a great way that, like, when I'm speaking with my friends and family about mindfulness, you know, when I bring in Google into it and say, you know, Google practice mindfulness, or they have something set up so that, and that always makes them think, okay, well, if businesses are open to mindfulness, then perhaps, you know, it just...
It's a good selling point.
Yeah, it's a door opener, and it allows me then to have a conversation and say, well, if it's good enough for Google, not only good Google, but
Goldman Sachs,
the Navy, and here in the UK, the NHS, and, you know, schools now are adopting it, then it allowed me to take it away from this hippie kind of Buddhist fringe conversation and say, no, you know the leading companies are now, you know, and so many Fortune companies are applying it. So how did that transition take place?
So remember that I just suddenly realized that, yep, I was happy,
yep,
if nothing's happening. That was in 2003.
Mm-hmm.
And I was taking a walk. I remember it was August. I just don't remember the exact day, but I remember the exact location when I had that epiphany.
Yeah.
And then immediately after that, I told myself something, like, still in the same location, still in 1 or 2 minutes. I was like, if me, like this person, if this person can become happy, then everybody can do it. And if everybody does it, what is the implication? The implication is we create the conditions for world peace, mm-hmm, in one lifetime. World peace in one lifetime. And then I suddenly realized, this is it. This is what I want to do for the rest of my life. Create the conditions for world peace in my lifetime.
Yeah.
By scaling inner peace, inner joy, and compassion worldwide.
Oh, yeah, wonderful.
Yeah, that was like, and then of course, an hour later, I was like, "Really, you?" and then it came back after a few days, and then because it kept coming back, I knew that was it.
Mm-hmm. Yes,
like, yes. That was my life purpose for the rest of my life. So based on that, it started fairly small. It started with there's a guy called Jonas in my company in Google at the time, and he started meditating. And then he was like, hey, why don't you join me? And then we kind of like started telling all our friends. We booked a meeting room in Google and tell our friends we are meditating on at Wednesdays at noon. Come join us.
Yes.
So on an average week, average Wednesday, there are between 3 to 7 people. So not very impressive. Right? And then I did something more after that. I started inviting people to come visit Google.
Mm.
So the first person was Alan Wallace. And Alan Wallace, the beginning was this. So as I started thinking more about this, I started to feel that the training of meditation needs to be data-driven.
Mm-hmm.
Sure.
It needs to be scientific.
Yeah.
Right? And back then, it was kind of a big deal. Right? Yeah. Science was like whoa, right? And I talked to a few leading scientists and Zen people and meditation teachers, and the reaction was the same. Reaction was, eh. And it's kind of nice. Yeah, but, you know, science, Zen, I mean, both from both sides, from the science side,
yeah,
and the meditation side, they're both like, eh.
Mm-hmm.
They don't oppose it, but they're like, eh, lukewarm. And then I got introduced to Alan Wallace through a friend of a friend, and I emailed him that, and he replied immediately. In 5 minutes, he said, this is precisely what I've been working on for the past few years, because the Dalai Lama told me to.
Mm.
And that was when I knew I was on the right track, right? Because right, the Dalai Lama and I can't both be wrong at the same time, right? So and that's how Alan Wallace and I became friends. And then through Alan, I got to know John Kabat-Zinn and so on and so forth. And then my circle just became bigger and bigger. And I just kept inviting them to come to Google and speak to Googlers. And then so it became a thing at Google.
Yeah.
And then I went beyond that. So I started bringing in courses, meditation classes. So obviously it was MBSR. So I brought in MBSR. It went well, but it didn't go well enough. And the reason was because it was a stress reduction class.
Yes.
And back then, when Google was a younger company, and like literally younger, because we were all younger back then, people were stressed on their like a badge of honor. I'm so stressed. I'm working 12 hours a day. Yeah, right. And they don't want to go to a stress reduction class. Mm-hmm. So I had to find a new doorway. Mm-hmm. And I figured the new doorway is success.
Yes.
Like this practice will help you become successful.
Yes.
It will help you earn more profits. And the side effect of that, which you cannot avoid, the unavoidable side effect is inner peace, inner joy, compassion, and world peace. Yeah.
So you packaged it in a way that it would be appealing.
So yes.
The compassion route, perhaps, but if it's success, then everyone wants success. Everyone wants, you know, increased productivity, money, etc. So that's the back
that's
door,
right.
Compassion through the back door.
Yeah.
That's my finding. My finding was, people want to be successful, they don't mind being happy, and they don't mind world peace.
Yeah.
So I put it as a starting point. So the question is how, right? Well, how do I do this? And I figured that the doorway was emotional intelligence.
Yeah.
Right? Because everybody knows EI is good for my career, it's good for profits.
Yeah.
But how do you train that? Nobody really knew at the time. Mm-hmm. And my conjecture was that, we know how to train the mind because of our meditators. So therefore, I say, therefore, we just have to tailor it so that we can train emotional intelligence in a way that help people succeed and where goodness is unavoidable. Yeah. That's it. And then so I got to know a friend called Daniel Goleman, who wrote a book on emotional intelligence. And then we worked together with a bunch of others, Zen master, a scientist. And it's kind of like a joke, right? A Zen master and scientist walking to a bar. So we did that. And we created Search Inside Yourself. Mm. And it became wildly popular in Google.
Yeah,
and I guess that's how the legend started.
Well, I have to comment that, you know, I like the almost some autobiographical elements of your new book. You know, mentioning the humble beginnings, the search, I suppose that, you know, and then finding money and success. But of course, that wasn't the key, and I think that's the message that very often people are misled. We always, that's a recurring theme in our podcast, that people try to pursue external, you know, you mentioned sort of sensual joy, you know, sort of sensual pleasures and, you know, the massaging of the ego, massaging of the ego. But actually, it's independent of that, isn't it? You know, and I find that, you know, very inspirational. And G often talks about.
Yeah, it's one of the hardest things. And then once you grasp that, I think that's where we really began our growth.
Right. In my opinion, I have to make a slight, there's a new one there, which is that sensual pleasure and ego pleasure, there's nothing wrong with them.
Mm-hmm.
Sure.
The problem is it's dependence.
Yes.
Is that if you're happy only if there are these sources of joy, then we have a problem.
Yeah.
Right. So therefore, if we can find joy that is independent of sensory and ego pleasure, then we have a stable source of joy and therefore happiness.
Mm-hmm. Yes. And I suppose it takes back a little bit of control, you know, that you are in charge of your, you know, happiness and joy, not dependent on external factors, which we know very often, almost always, is outside of our hands.
Mm-hmm. Yes, I don't disagree, but I don't see that as control. I see it as liberation.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yes, because I used to be, we are all slaves of ego pleasure and sense pleasure, and now we are less of a slave.
Less of a slave.
And eventually, the relationship goes from a slavery to one of friendship. Mm. So sensory pleasure is a friend.
Yes.
But it's somebody I hang out with, but not somebody I have to depend on.
Yes.
It's somebody I don't know, I have to take orders from.
Yeah.
So I think the biggest thing in this discussion is that I realized that joy, specifically access to joy, is highly trainable. Mm-hmm. That is a big piece. And then one of the key questions is, what's the difference between joy and happiness? Okay. Mm-hmm. So the definition I'm using is the one from Matthew Ricard, the happiest man in the world. I figure he knows a thing or two about happiness. And he defines happiness as a deep sense of flourishing that arises from an exceptionally healthy mind. Yeah. Not a fleeting emotion, not a mood, but an optimal state of being.
Yes.
And therefore, happiness is kind of a net effect over time. Mm-hmm. Right? So I kind of have a happy day. So not every moment is nice, but in general, it was nice. It was happy.
Yeah.
In contrast, joy is moment-to-moment pleasant emotion.
Yes.
Like it's fleeting and it comes and goes.
Yeah.
And the relationship between the two, therefore, is that joy is the building block of happiness.
Yeah.
So in a happy day or in a happy life, not every moment is joyful, but there's no such thing as joyless happiness.
Yes.
Therefore, once you train the ability to access joy, independent of most circumstances, then you can use the joy to build happiness.
Yes. And then in your book, you touched about how joy can live alongside suffering. And I think that really struck me when I read your book because, you know, for a lot of people, I speak to people regularly that suffer with severe depression where they regularly have suicidal thoughts. And that I've said to me, you know, through doing, a mindfulness-based stress reduction course, it's really turned their life around or doing some form of meditation. Can you perhaps talk about that?
Okay. Yes. So the thing about the training of joy, and can I go a little bit about the training of joy?
Yeah. Yes, absolutely.
Yeah, time for that. Okay. So there are three pillars in the training of joy. The first pillar is easing into joy. Mm-hmm. And that is putting the mind in a state of ease. And when the mind is at ease, joy arises. Mm-hmm. It takes some training. So not everybody will get it the first time. But eventually, everybody will reach a state. Sorry, that was an Amber Alert. It's very okay. let me say that again. Where was I? Okay, yeah. Ease.
Yes.
When the mind is a state of ease, joy spontaneously arises. For some people, it takes a while. Mm-hmm. But eventually, everybody finds it. And the reason is because joy is a default state of mind. There's a feature of mind, and there's a technical term, sukha. There is a subtle joy that is very subtle. So in order to access it, you need to quiet the mind and pay attention. But once you can access it, you can access it very reliably because it's extremely sustainable. And so therefore, when the mind is at ease, sometimes or with enough skill training, you can access it on demand. And that joy reinforces the ease. So the mind is even more at ease and then reinforces the joy.
Yes.
It becomes a cycle. That's fascinating.
Yeah.
So that's the foundation of the joy that's independent of sense and ego pleasure.
Yeah.
So that's the first pillar. By itself, life-changing.
Yeah.
Yes. The second pillar is inclining the mind towards joy. And the word inclining, in the old Buddhist scriptures, inclination of mind is compared to the inclination of a mountain, mountain slope. When a mountain slope in a certain way, when water flows, it flows effortlessly in that direction. The key word is effortless.
Yeah.
So if your mind is inclined toward anger, every other thing makes you angry. Inclined towards depression, every other thing makes you depressed.
Yeah.
However, if you change the inclination of mind to joy, then every other thing effortlessly bring about joy.
Oh.
It's fascinating. Then the question is how? Is this amazing? How do I do it? Is it hard? Turns out it's very simple. There are a couple of ways, but the key one is to notice thin slices of joy in life, which already happened. For example, if I'm thirsty, there's a thin slice of joy.
Yeah.
Thin in space and time, right?
Yeah.
Thin in space as in it wasn't like, yes, it was like, it was nice.
Mm. Yeah.
It lasted like 2-3 seconds.
Mm. Mm-hmm. But you've noticed right? it, yeah.
Yeah, but we never notice it. But once you start noticing it, you find it everywhere.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Every time I drink, every time I eat, take a bite, every time I walk, every time I see an old friend or a new friend, and so on and so forth. Every moment I see my daughter and so on.
Yeah.
It's a slice of joy.
Yes.
So first, I mean, obviously it makes you happier, but even more important than that is that when you do that, when you start noticing that, you familiarize the mind with joy.
Mm.
And the word familiar is related to the word family.
Mm.
So joy becomes a member of family, becomes like a best friend, always there for you, somebody can always count on.
Yeah.
Imagine having that relationship with joy.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And then that's how you incline the mind towards joy.
Mm-hmm.
Very simple practices, like noticing.
Yeah.
So that's the second thing. The third leg is uplifting the mind with goodness. So for example, with kindness. Mm-hmm. Is there time for experiment? 10 seconds?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
I ask you to bring to mind somebody you care about and just think, I wish for this person to be happy. You notice you were happy doing that? Right? Just by thinking, I wish for that person to be happy, that alone makes you happy.
Yeah.
So that's a word for that method.
Yeah.
Loving kindness. Loving kindness is defined as the wish for others to be happy.
Hmm.
And every time method is practiced,
yeah.
There is a jolt of joy.
Mm.
It's fascinating and it's reliable.
Yeah. Yeah.
Right. And the effect was fascinating even to me. Because I assigned this as homework during one of my public talks. Also on a Monday evening. I said, tomorrow Tuesday is a work day, try this. Every hour, spend 10 seconds secretly wishing for two people outside office to be happy. Secretly. So don't say it aloud, just think, right?
Yeah.
Go back to work, it changes. Yeah. See what happens.
Yeah.
Wednesday morning, I received an email from a total stranger.
Mm.
And this person says, she said, I hate my job. I hate coming to work every single day.
Mm-hmm.
But I did the homework on Tuesday. And Tuesday was my happiest day in 7 years.
Wow.
Happiest day in 7 years.
Yeah, what it such a simple practice.
Thinking, or not just simple.
Mm.
It's thinking. Right? It's like the other practices, it takes a little bit of practice. Like easing takes some practice. You know, inclining takes some practice.
Yeah.
But this, all it takes is to bring up a thought.
Mm.
And every adult I've ever known in my life knows how to bring up a thought effortlessly.
Yeah.
Like experiment, think of an elephant. Mm. Like everybody can do that.
Yeah.
So therefore, if you can get a joy, not just any kind of joy, wholesome kind of joy, the type of joy that brings you to the gates of heaven when you die.
Yeah.
Like wholesome joy with a single thought.
Yeah.
So the craziest thing, it's the easiest thing in the world, right? And it's the best thing in the world. It's crazy. Yeah.
It reminds me of there's a meditation, you know, I've downloaded so many guided meditations, but one of them is when you offer love and kindness to yourself and then to someone that you know and then someone that maybe you don't know so well, and then you start doing it to people that you may not like so much and then to someone that you hate. And it was the first time where I really kind of offered good intentions and good wishes to people that genuinely I had no time for, or that in my mind I'd labeled them as some people that I hated, or that I you know. And so just that, and then when it says, all right, now think of someone that you may not like or you despise, and so I just did it, but then offering them loving kindness, and that it was just such a new experience for me. But then, so when you say that, it kind of, you know, it brings some similarity. I guess getting out of your comfort zone and maybe perhaps offering kindness and wishing good upon people that perhaps you're not accustomed to doing so.
Okay, tell a story. This is powerful.
Okay.
So I think last year or the year before, Google was making a documentary on me. And as part of that, they went around the world talking to people who say I've changed their lives. So I didn't know anything about this.
Yeah.
All I knew was that they were making a documentary.
Okay.
And so this was a surprise to me. And then somebody came back, when the documentary maker came back, and she said, you have to hear this story. Right. And so there was a young man from Egypt who read Search Inside Yourself. And he did that exercise that we talked about in the book, right?
Yeah.
Wishing for others to be happy. Mm-hmm. And then just thinking, not just wishing for them happy, just reminding myself, that person is just like me.
Ah,
human being, mm-hmm. just like me.
Mm-hmm.
Wants to be happy, just like me.
Mm-hmm.
Has suffering and want to be free from suffering, just like me.
Mm-hmm.
Right? And so this young man, his name is Omar. He read the book, he did the exercises.
Mm-hmm.
And then he came to a realization. He realizes that people from the other religion, people from that religion has the right to live.
Hmm.
It changes his entire orientation.
Sure.
So it's mind-blowing. If we have thousands of those, of people like that, who realize
that
my enemy, even he is a human being, yeah. just like me, has a right to live.
Yeah.
This begins to solve a lot of our problems.
Yes.
Yeah, and a very important point on that is that I have a lot of conversations with my friends and colleagues and peers about the doom and gloom, and, you know, how bad things are in the world and this and that. But, you know, a lot of people are unaware that there is a whole wave, and there's so many different areas in which there's progress being made towards peace, towards altruism and compassion, of yes. which obviously mindfulness is probably one of the biggest. You know, you can't pick up a magazine or read a newspaper or article about it, but, you know, it does bring huge hope when you see, you know, people paying attention to this, and the stories like you're saying about that guy Omar, where, you know, just educating yourself a bit
yeah.
will allow and can almost necessarily bring you to these conclusions.
Oh, not education, training.
Ah, yes, training.
That's the difference. Yeah, training is like going to the gym.
Mm-hmm.
It's like you have to like train, you have to do something rather yeah. than just think I'm going to the gym. Right?
yeah.
I want to get back to the original question on suffering.
Yes.
Specifically not suffering, specifically pain. And there's a difference.
Yes.
Yeah. And we can go to the difference in a while. But the thing about, so one thing I found fascinating about the practices of joy the most powerful application is in pain. It's in the middle of pain.
Yeah.
It blew my mind. Right? And question is why? The first reason is that the same practices we use to bring up joy are also the same practices we use to deal with pain. For example, calming the mind. Remember we say ease the mind in order to get joy? And if we're in the middle of crisis and in the middle of pain,
yeah.
the first thing we do is calm the mind.
Mm-hmm.
If you do that, half the problem gets solved.
Yeah.
Right? So the same practice. Right? Another example is loving kindness. Again, we did it just now as part of how to get joy. And if you're in the middle of difficulty, this kind of same relationship, somebody say something or make you really, really upset, mm-hmm. and if you practice loving kindness, I wish for this person to be happy, he or she, just like me.
Mm.
I wish for me to be happy. Just do that. And like half the anger disappears in 5 minutes.
Yes.
Right? It's fascinating, right? So again, same practice for healing, for dealing with pain. So that's the first reason. Right, because the same practices are applicable in both places.
Mm-hmm.
Again, and then make comparison be like exercise. Right? I mean, you go running, you can use that for health and fitness. At the same time, when you're in danger, same skill, running away.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Okay, so that's one. The other one is that it turns out that, this surprised me, is that you can experience joy in the midst of pain.
Yeah, now this was the key yeah. thing, so please go ahead.
It blew my mind. And the way I experienced it was this. There was a period of time where I went through a long and difficult emotional pain. And I'm not, how should I say, I'm no stranger to the feeling that constantly thinking I should be dying, that okay. I should be dead.
Sure. Mm-hmm.
So I went through one of those phases, long and difficult. And then by then my joy practice was very strong already. And so every now and then, out of nowhere, I experienced an unadulterated joy.
Mm-hmm.
Right? So I just walking between offices or something, whatever it is. And then suddenly I just realized, oh, today is a wonderful, beautiful day. And I was so happy.
Mm-hmm.
And that lasts for like 2-3 minutes. And I'm back to misery. I'm back to life. I want to die. I want to die. Mm-hmm. And I was like, I must be going crazy, more crazy than I usually am. And the question I asked myself was this, the engineering question, if my joy is so strong, why doesn't it dissolve away the pain? Or if the pain is so strong, why doesn't it dissolve away the joy?
Mm.
Right? And then I realized that joy and pain are mutually insoluble. So they don't dissolve each other.
Mm.
So if one is much stronger than the other, it displaces the other.
Yeah.
Right. So you have so much joy, the pain kind of you don't notice. It's get displaced, and vice versa.
Mm.
Like you're playing game, and you kind of don't notice a backache. Joy displaces.
Yeah.
However, if they're fairly, they're both equally strong, they exist side by side.
Yeah.
Mm.
And the best learning, the best example of this, came from meeting a new friend, Rigoberta Menchu. Rigoberta was a Nobel Peace Prize winner from Guatemala.
Hmm.
And her, so I got to know her, and she was like the stereotypical Nobel Peace Prize winner. Right? She was kind, she was warm, she was nice, she was happy. Everybody loved her. She loved everybody. She's always laughing.
Yeah.
Right. And I said, this is a wonderful woman, and of course she's still serving the world, right? And then I got to know her a little bit, and it doesn't take that long. 1-2 hours, you can spend time with her. You notice that right beneath the surface, there's so much pain that's still there. And it's understandable once you know her life story, right? Her father was burned alive, right, by the government. Burned alive.
Mm.
Right? Her mom was kidnapped by the government, tortured, raped, murdered, and then body was dumped on the side of the road to feed wild animals, right? And she lost her brothers in a similar way. She lost her son. Mm. And I was like, any one of these events is traumatic that scar you for life. Right? And she has all of them. Right? So the pain is still there. And then how do I explain all the joy, all the goodness? Right? She's still in service of people. Like when the last time I met her, she came to Singapore for 40 hours to talk to young people. And then she went back to Europe to do other work, humanitarian work. She's still doing that in her joy, in her goodness and everything. So how do I explain that? And then I figured it out as I was talking to her. First thing I figured out was that joy and pain exist side by side, and Rico Bertà was using her joy as a skillful container for the pain. And the analogy is putting a cast along your leg when you have a fracture.
Mm-hmm.
You have a serious fracture, you put a cast, it does two things.
Yeah.
It prevents further damage,
mm-hmm.
and it allows healing to happen.
Yeah.
So she's using her joy to contain the pain so that the pain doesn't cause damage, and allows healing over time.
Mm-hmm.
And for me, that was fascinating. And for me, I feel that I had to write that chapter.
Yeah,
it's a book on joy, but I had to write a whole chapter on pain, because that is the most powerful application of joy.
And in your book, Joy, you mention a similar story about a lady who loses her husband and her child and her family. And I think the beauty about those stories is that those pains, which we would classify as, you know, code red, you know, the worst of the worst, losing a member of your family to a terrible death, be it a murder, a rape, so there is nothing worse than that in life. However, even in those moments, and even after, so, there is joy that can live alongside that.
Yes.